Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Susan Stringfellow. Susan Stringfellow received her MFA from Carlow University, studying with American and Irish poets while completing her first manuscript of poetry entitled Lathered Mouth. She has been most recently published in an anthology by a Pittsburgh, Texas press, and also in the Carlow Journal. She teaches at Point Park University. Hi, Susan. How are you?
Hi, Jan. Very well, thank you. Yeah. How are you?
Great. Welcome. And
thank you.
I'm really excited to hear some of your poems. This is your first time on Prosody, so go ahead and read.
Well, thank you very much. This first poem is called Fragrant Sky. The clear voice of the river spilling out of mouth when I say I love you, and the dirt rough and my tongue's cattail grit ripping the roof open. Because, of course, it's never said. You touch me there, in the bloody land, where palmed coolness lay, chased as blue herons flying among clouds. This next one is called Mark of Humanity. And now a poem to an amniotic. Get used to it. Life is an ocean, swallowing the sun, and the moon's skirt sways, like when mother walks the coastline inside your house and hums magnetic, tinkling bell chimes on the meridians of your routing bodies, seen only in shimmer. Hush, hush, the amniotic, sack made of woman's tears and flowers torn asunder, dripping vanilla goodness. Life smells of brine and pain, but that pain and the heart, which is shred to oblivion, floats in a consuming sun. Loving and fearsome, where mind glides, if you do not drown in terror, a lotus undone. Unhinged we begin, so you will know forever the silences in which are our beginnings, in which we have an origin like water. Yet so attached to mother, to the blood, the basis from which we rise. The rushes of life are different from currents in the sack, water dweller. Air drinker. You will not know where you are in the sack of the world. You won't know who you've been, and you will drown when you feel the world's removed your knees with a bullwhip and mace, and your dreams have flown off timorous, beakless, footless chickens inches from the butcher's blade. Or a person you believed in gives you up as slaughtered wood. Or someone you thought might love you doesn't. And there comes a point at which giving up seems the last act of survival, and the only thing left is to bleach white as sun. Because there are only two specks of refuge, the sun and the hummus, each radiantly suffocating. And you will seek to walk darkening trails only when you no longer take to human love as the path of your salvation. The reoccurring tale whispering on the vine is, there was a girl who used to be a baby, and her soul was handled by the most vile fingers, and the muck sticks to her voice, her feet, hands, heart, for the remnant and yolk of your born days. I did forget to mention that that actually has an excerpt from an Evan Bolin poem, the part about the silences in the beginning and having an origin like water. So I was very influenced by Evan Bolin. This next poem is called Communion. There were women in the wall who ordered themselves, stoned in so that only a slit was left and they could breathe and be fed. I have not learned to be a lover. I have only one opening left among stacked boundaries through which I breathe and eat food offered. The women in the wall, all of them were looking to God for the love of a man who did not care for the cleanliness of their homes or the radiance of figures and faces. What happened that so many women shut themselves away from a world of green, breathy air and the hands of men? Why? Was the stony coffin refuge for ever-thinning women? They became mouthpieces for God, visited and rice-fed by the hands of the faithful. How can I ask him to feed me, a woman in the wall, feeling guilt for my unbidden sin, looking to heaven for accountability for the hands of others? How do I let him feed me through the tiny slit I've left, love like bread and sweet burgundy wine? And what is the nature of bread and sweet burgundy wine? This next poem is called Consumed, and it really comes from looking at a picture of a bog body. Skin leathered, the tea-colored man lies curled on his side, throat slit. His clothes, hair, smile, still whole, fleshed and hollow, hand-reaching, no calluses on fingertips but fingerprints that leave a delicate mark on this world. Peace sleeps on his face, though his bludgeoned head and cut throat speak clearly of murder. Always the earth crawls, pinching back her own, and here on this land we affect to stand, gobbling pesticides and preservatives like Flintstone vitamins, convinced of our natural supremacy, of our science, our take of dry ground. Bodies lie centuries waiting to affect a story. Perhaps our hearts will petrify. It's not impossible. Scientists say we're 80% preserved now. But when our hands reach out, who are we reaching to? God or some other woman, dog, friend? The last breath, the first piece of dirt we smell like home?
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Susan Stringfellow, reading her work. Susan, I want to ask you about this voice that's in your work. I mean, it seems like there's more than one voice happening, but there's a great, so far, pervasive sense of haunting in your work. And listening to you read is effectively disturbing.
Oh, no.
Well, I mean, in that way that it's, you know, powerful because your voice is soft and has this distant quality about it, and you're reading about trauma, and it's a little chilling. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
can you talk about that a little, and how much of that is intentional or how
none of it?
Like, well, come on. I mean, I know you didn't maybe script your own voice, but you wrote the poems. So.
I did write the poems.
Yes, you did.
Yes, that part was intentional. you know, in a way, I mean, we all write about what we write about, and these poems come from a time. You know, I'm working through my own history, my own sense of history, and what's bothered me in the world or in my life, and probably learned at some point. Wow, probably learned more than I realized. Like, I think you're picking it up more than I am. To, you know, distance myself and to be able to be objective. It's quite easy for me to say something in a poem and probably not get – I can get the full implication, but I can't really understand the full impact, especially, you know, if I'm speaking softly.
Mm-hmm.
And also I don't realize how softly I speak, you know.
Yeah.
And I've never even realized that the two would go together to create that impression, you know, or feeling, that feeling would come over a reader. So I hope it works somehow to benefit.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it gives an effect, a chilling effect, and it sort of, I think, strengthens the haunting nature of some of this work. For example, you know, of course, it's the writing that is creating this, the strong images and the tough material, but the women in the wall. I mean, there's so many phrases that I've written down. There were so many to choose from, you know. But, you know, phrases like hush, hush, the amniotic, I mean, with your voice reading it, has a different effect. And I think it's, like I said, effective. But then you have, you know, many details that have a lot of power in their usage, like, you know, the you have bullwhip and mace and the blade coming out. I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of weapons here. Yeah, there's a lot of violence. Yeah. But I think that's you've brought up an interesting idea that how to write about, you know, disturbing material without being sensational at all, which, you know, this is not. And yet, how do you enter that material as a writer without getting totally freaked out yourself? You know, whether any of it is autobiographical or not is irrelevant, but it's, you know, it's like you said, you're upset by things happening in the world. So how do you deal with that as a woman writer writing about trauma? How do you manage that objectivity?
Interesting. I'll be interesting to listen to the show play later because I want to hear this effect because I'm not aware of it. But honestly, I would say it's rather an organic process. I mean, perhaps I just take in things from the world and from the experience, my environment, more almost bodily than I realize. And when I'm bringing that back out again, it's sifting through my own psychology. And I'm starting to think also probably, you know, some deeper sense of myself, like my subconscious is aligning with my conscious here and I have things coming out. So what you're pointing to is that there's greater violence in my writing and perhaps in me, you know, or that I'm not accessing on a regular basis, that I'm sounding quiet and yet I'm speaking of violent things and I'm speaking of trauma. And I think that in order to handle trauma, sometimes we may be addressing violent things or prone to say things that might sound violent, partly not realizing how violent it just may sound to somebody else, and partly because in the act of not knowing oneself, what I could be drawn to certain imagery that is expressing something, and yet I'm not, even for myself, it's a discovery process.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, as a writer, you're going to write what you need to write and not question all that, you know, where it comes from and what it means, et cetera. And that's what we do as writers. And okay, why don't you read some more?
Oh, okay. This next poem is called Tattered. The silent life of a woman who is neither grown nor child, neither lovely nor ugly, is only wind on water. Stroking time as it ambles, shifting like the seashore, thistles die on her porch, robins waste in her lap. Sisters clack needles and tongues, hoping to set the whole to rights. Father scowls for neat lines, but her mind is gone, and she drops a stitch. The man who stroked her like a swan thought her sexy as water rings, as wind on a pond. He never made sense of torn scripture in her eyes or her cooing, an exiled daughter's canticle. He couldn't watch her cringe to Sallow Lake as his demands weighed on fractured wits. He only wanted her more, more, and she just took it and took it and took it. And he wondered why she didn't put up much fight and why she was so quiet, and was it because she had children? Yes, she said. That was the reason, no matter, that three times she'd said no, that he never tripped in the pale iris of her eyes, that he gathered to his chest a chattel woman, unable to reject a man, long and make it stick, that there was more love inside than taking could ever release, and so no tenderness was thrown on her salted garden. Her hands quivered like splayed pin oak leaves, futile, in the blank of winter, she cried for her past of gorse and sumac berries, and how early she learned to give her teeth away like biscuits, and for the trust that love would one day float green as ocean in her scarred pockets, and could she only have reprieve for the love of God someday to find home in a man's heart who has eyes for her fresh as a January moon? But now, the man she loves is gone to another, all those words she thought she heard, our thighs chafing, autumn rubbing. Her clothes are soot because she sold her appeal to this coarser man, seeing just what he wants to see, that she loves him as a matter of course, and not her, shoes floating on the water, dead as fish. And then, it does catch my attention now how so many of the poems, this is also about trauma. This one's called The Seventh Year. He wore a wilted James Bond glamour and a jangling rum and coke between his legs as he fondled the stick shift, revving his engine at decency and other stop signs. She wore the Christmas gifts he bought her, French bikini underwear in 8 pastel colors and a hand muppet with interchangeable face parts. He asked her to slip into her fresh undies, strut like a model, dance like a stripper, euphoric from the make-believe, satin scarcely covering her hairless crotch. She asked, why? He tucked his girl into a rented bed, turned out his conscience, cast a sparkling girlhood to the curb sewer. She tucked her mind to slumber in the pressed silence of the curtained room, swathed so from outside eyes of broad sun. He watched the 71 Bears-Dolphin game. He forgot he'd pledged to watch with his son and coaxed the walls of her thighs open. She watched his old face and the stripy, glimmery wallpaper of the Golden Strip Holiday Inn. He touched the Georgia O'Keeffe between her legs. She touched a white cotton sheet, pond ice, and the leekweeds held some face against the glass. He screamed, frigid like your mother, cursing her 60 pounds and spacious eyes. She screamed, I want my mom! He claimed, nothing happened, and isn't she a little nuts anyway? She claimed, I told a police officer later to protect my stepsister, and he said, is that all? Could have been a lot worse. The silence after called no investigation up to save another Kello girl.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Susan Stringfellow, reading her work. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the, there's a sense of formality in your, a lot of your language, and I think some half rhyme, some end rhyme, not perfect rhyme so much, but can you talk about those kind of choices in your work and maybe in relation to content?
Definitely. When I feel that I'm writing about something that's clearly traumatic, then my language will become much shorter and sharper, and I will sometimes begin to use sound techniques that create a rhythm. So I have really short lines, creating a rhythm in which there's echoes, sound echoes, in between the lines. And let's see here. The sound techniques, that's something that was really taught in Ireland a lot, as well as with, you know, the American poets. And it was something I really took to. And I think I employ a lot of them unconsciously. On the other hand, when I'm editing my poems, I'm quite aware of what's going on. Maybe not every single time, but very often I'm aware of the sound techniques going on.
So you change some of – you do some of that bolstering with sound or working with sound in revision?
I do, yeah. And sometimes I'll tone it back as well, you know. I do like to play with sound. It was something I really took to. The formal sensibility, that's almost an unconscious – I think that that's also an unconscious thing with me. Mm-hmm. I don't know where it comes from, and I can't always see it as clearly as other people can either.
Right, right. I mean, some really interesting phrases, you know, in the salted garden, in the blank of water, those kind of phrases that you really don't hear often. I mean, they're beautiful, but they do have a resonance that reminds us of, you know, another way of speaking, you know, maybe a more formal or a distant way of speaking, which I think has an interesting interaction with that intensity of that content. And sort of acts as a balance, you know, a grounding in a way.
But maybe I do unconsciously employ, it is distancing perhaps, and then I'm employing that because I am speaking about something so intense. I'm speaking about private experiences, women's experiences often, and experiences that we've been taught not to address.
Right.
And that if you wanted to be kind to a woman or a young girl, you would not say, this happened here, or this happened here. But I think that I'm addressing it because I think it's an important thing to address, that nobody should have to deal with these kinds of violences and suppressions. And that I think that our society needs to wake up and say, this is just another way that we've created a taboo, which is incredibly unhealthy.
Right, right.
Yeah,
and I know that it's, you know, it's a brave thing to do to write about this kind of material. And you know, you use the word unconscious a lot, or self-conscious and subconscious. And it's no surprise because, you know, I imagine and know to some degree that this takes a lot to dig into this kind of material.
A lot of delving.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, too, I was influenced by Anna Akhmatova and the idea of, you know, the trauma and how she can't even really express everything. And sometimes the images come out and they're they're clear and clean and sharp, but they're surprising, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's because that level of emotion, when you can't even take it in yourself,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's the kind of language that will come out from people. It's almost like a literary scream, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Could you read some more?
Sure. Thank you. This one is called The Cream Door, and the women are not traumatized in this poem. Cascades of pale, catalpa flowers, over the stone garden stairs, and the birds singing here and there, milky tears. We women float up a taupe stream, fair in our linen, dresses and pantaloons, to a pearl bank, further away than knowledge, where the green world of ferns and sun-draped ashes eclipse the common sense, you see. Fawns are all but blanched, and the fruits lack color, even eyelashes are pallid, and we are in the blind, washing ourselves. Ecru fades and is washed, awake in the blind, and we are washed, awake in the lush, green that leads in the giggle of a child's hiccup, to the cream door, to the cream door. This next poem, Minikai, is very influenced by Japanese. Actually, this has to do with incense and the art of incense. In Japan, the art of tea, art of poetry, art of incense. And it also employs, Minikai means ugly. Kiara means beautiful. And it employs a little bit of Chinese mythology. The House of Cinnamon is a god made that for his wife. So this is called Minikai. Pretending to elegance, carrying incense in your sleeves, to draw peacocks and kiara women. This floating world is all you will ever know. Why can't you hear the incense? The river has shattered. Through trees I see her, setting silk in the bed. Later, she is a meadow for you. You will never build our house of cinnamon wood. We will never know each other by scent again. Why did I listen to you, moon in branches, when you trifled with bright pearls in your pocket? I should have also said that in the art of incense, you hear the incense because it falls on you like Buddha's words. That's the idea.
What do you mean by that?
It's interesting. They would get into these gatherings and come in and experience quite intense incenses and of all different mixtures. And initially, it was more of a spiritual practice, and then it became more courtly. And because it was a spiritual practice, the experience of and the intensity all of these different fragrances coming together was like listening to, like, Buddha's words coming upon you.
Okay, so you mean metaphorically, it's coming upon you, or it's actually the...
Well, the incense, you're actually smelling it. So in some way, it's coming upon you, but it's as though it's creating a realization or a new state.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's an interesting tradition. This one is also an Asian-influenced poem. It's called Cloud. The world is boundless and blue, dressed in smudges of white. When the snowy egrets fly in rippling heat, touching cool water, melting. This next one is called The Pecking Order. The Pecking Order. That's my leg, Steve shouted, 16-year-old king of the house. Vicky skimmed under the fray, snatching the largest breast. 13-year-old Chris, second brother, claimed the other leg while Mom cut the second breast quietly, sharing half with middle child, Scott, which left Kurt 5th out of 6 and myself 6th out of 6 with a back and 2 wings. When Johnny White came, he waited politely for dishes to be passed, but in seconds, no bread, no peas, no applesauce, no mashed potatoes, no chicken, except the wings and back, upon which Kurt and I had yet to pounce. Johnny's plate lay stark. Kurt hesitated, but I screamed, "Those are my chicken wings." I felt bad for Johnny, maybe Kurt too, but those wings had to be mine. What was mine was a breath, taken when my mother left me at 2. What was mine was a river of words I could never release, that loss, the question of belonging or not. What was mine I could pack in a suitcase. When I was driven to the house, after proper introductions all round, because the eager faces I didn't recognize all remembered me, I heard scraping in the walls absent of money, clothes, food, sheets, where a fall of broken shells cast out of the way by the God we prayed was on our side. And so I chewed that chicken wing, the pink tips of my fingers stripping the carcass of blonde meat. Too small, I was too small, you see, to be of much relevance. Well, it ended that Chris scraped half his untouched food onto Johnny's plate, which left Johnny in a quandary about whether to eat second-hand rations or not. Chris stuffed down 4 PB&Js that night anyway, deaf to the whispering walls. Kurt grumbled, choking on a chicken back and heel of bread, and Johnny left the table a witness to the pecking order.
I think we have time for one more poem.
Okay. This is a poem. We were talking about language and expressing trauma or upset, and how does the language change. This is one of those poems. Hoary faces. Even in ourselves, we have much to overcome. My hair, the weed and the tears, gray and white and blonde again. Never sincere, talking amongst themselves. The ringing in my head from wrapping myself with my hands. Listen, in the attic, old people are dancing.
It's the poetry of Susan Stringfellow. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jan.
It's great. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP. Hi, I'm Jan Beatty. This week on Prosody.
The silent life of a woman who is neither grown nor child, neither lovely nor ugly, is only wind on water.
The poetry of Susan Stringfellow. Please tune in this Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers, 91.3 WYEP.